Today, justice was served. It's been a long time coming. It arrived when a convicted felon named William H. Cosby Jr. left the courtroom in handcuffs, headed off to state prison.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Tuesday, Bill Cosby, once known to millions as America's dad, was sentenced to 3 to 10 years in state prison for drugging and sexually assaulting a woman in his home in 2004.
He was convicted of sexually assaulting one woman, Andrea Constand, even though we know that there are at least 60 others, probably hundreds more. But given the facts and the law that the judge had to work with, I think this was a fair sentence.
That's Lisa Bloom, an attorney with the Bloom Firm, representing Janice Dickinson, a former model and judge for America's Next Top Model. Dickinson alleges that Cosby drugged and raped her in 1982 at a hotel in Lake Tahoe, Nevada.
She doesn't want to do any interviews right now, but she wants people to know that she was never the same after Bill Cosby raped her. She says, "Therapy has helped me some, but it has not helped to restore my innocence."
Lisa there is reading from a part of a victim impact statement Janice Dickinson brought to the courtroom in Pennsylvania and had hoped to read. The judge did not allow her to do so, but yesterday Lisa told us that the sentence was a victory nonetheless.
Oh, this is a huge step forward for the Me Too movement, for victims. I mean, let's not lose sight of that. 3 years ago, I don't think there's really anyone who thought that Bill Cosby could be convicted of felony sex crimes and go to prison. I mean, this was unthinkable. Well, today the unthinkable became a reality.
Graham Boley was in the courtroom on Tuesday. He's an investigative reporter at the New York Times who's covered the Cosby case since 2014.
This had been a long journey to get there since Mr. Cosby's arrest in 2015. We'd been through many prosecution and defense fights, and then we'd had the trial and the conviction in April, of course. And so this was sort of the final moment. The drama was building. The courtroom was packed over the 2 days. Many other women who have accused Mr. Cosby of sexual assault were in the room, as they have been throughout the trial. They were very expectant. Mr. Cosby was there, Andrea Constand and her family. And then the judge gave a very impressive argument before he gave the sentencing. And when he did, Mr. Cosby didn't react. But then we saw him walk from the courthouse in handcuffs. And that was quite a moment, I must say.
You know, it took us forever. It feels like it took us forever to get here. This is the second trial after an earlier mistrial. Was there something different about this trial that finally resulted in a verdict?
I think there were two things, yeah. One, the second trial in April, the Judge O'Neill allowed five other women to testify. And their testimony was very emotional and very jarring. And I think it had a big impact on the jury. Compared to the first trial, the mistrial, when there was only one woman who testified, didn't go so well. We were also in a new era, of course, we can't ignore. And that was represented in the courtroom by a psychologist who I thought was very impressive. And yesterday, the district attorney, when asked what was the difference, he said this person, Dr. Ziv, and she talked about the way in which people who suffer sexual assault behave and why they don't come forward for many months, sometimes years, why they behave in the way they do. And the defense had used Andrea Constand's behavior. She didn't come forward for a year. As a big kind of way to blame her and to attack her during the first trial. And this psychologist and the new era we're in meant that Andrea's behavior had far more credibility. I think those are the two big differences.
And of course, Bill Cosby was taken to prison yesterday. What is the appeal process from what you understand so far moving forward? Does he plan to?
They've said they're going to appeal. There are a number of appeal issues which are very clear. They've been signaling. They've been attacking the judge for the past few weeks and his integrity, saying he's biased. I think it's going to be one, maybe a couple of appeals there. The big one is the judge's decision to allow the five women in. That was a really kind of potent decision and pushed the envelope in legal terms. And it was quite rare. And they're going to say that was unfair.
Graham Boley is an investigative reporter at the New York Times who's covered the Cosby case since 2014. Graham, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
As Bill Cosby was being taken to prison, his spokesman Andrew Wyatt stood outside the courthouse in the pouring rain to deliver a statement to the media.
I believe and think it is important to point out that this has been the most racist and sexist trial in the history of the United States. Dr. Cosby has been one of the greatest civil rights leaders in the United States for over the last 50 years. What is going on in Washington today with Judge Kavanaugh is part of that sex war that Judge O'Neill along with his wife are a part of.
That's right. He called it a sex war. And I think that deserves a bigger conversation. So I've got Brittany Cooper on the line. She's a professor at Rutgers University, and she's also the author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot to unpack in this segment. Let's start with what was said in that quote here. We have Cosby spokesman once again saying, quote here, "This is the most racist and sexist trial in the history of the United States." Would love to get your thoughts on that.
Well, clearly that person doesn't understand how either racism or sexism work. What is sexist is that Bill Cosby was able, over the course of over 50 years, if we believe all of the allegations, to terrorize women, to sexually harass them as a matter of course, and then to violently sexually assault and rape dozens of victims and survivors. That is the epitome of sexism. We do not need to equivocate about that. I think that we can all concede, particularly for African Americans who are watching this and who are wondering if Harvey Weinstein will meet the same fate, or wondering how we have a president in the White House who is an admitted sexual assaulter, a Supreme Court nominee who I believe the allegations against. We are wondering whether these white men will be held to account. And I think that it's fine to say that our criminal justice system is racially inequitable, that it is often downright racist towards Black people and towards Black men. And yet none of that is an excuse or should excuse Cosby's terrible and terroristic behavior to all of these women he has encountered and harmed. And we don't need to use the racism of the system as an excuse to try to let Cosby off the hook for his bad behavior. And as a woman and as a Black person, I am appalled at anybody who would seek to do that.
And Brittany, I think, you know, we've heard similar, this sort of reminds me of back in the 80s and 90s when we had this culture war fight. Now we're talking about sex wars here and, of course, why it invoked Kavanaugh as well. And it sort of took me back to what we've all been talking about, the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, where Thomas himself said, you know, described what he was going through as a, quote, high-tech lynching. And, you know, again, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this type, the racial dynamics being played out here at these levels.
Absolutely. So that's essentially what this commenter was trying to invoke this spokesperson. He was trying to invoke the Clarence Thomas moment and essentially to play on Black people's emotions and their connection to Bill Cosby's incredible body of artistic work that so many of us value and grew up on. He's trying to invoke that essentially to say what the conspiracy theorists have been saying, right? This is a conspiracy to take down the Black man. And what becomes even more interesting is that now he's trying to put it in a broader context to say that this is this broader cultural conspiracy against men. No, the real conspiracy has been that men have out loud, hidden in plain sight, have terrorized women and have experienced no consequences from it. The question for us has to be not why is this happening to Bill Cosby, but rather how did Cosby and Trump and Kavanaugh, men who have done harmful things to women that by all accounts other people knew about, witnessed, saw, and helped in some ways to facilitate, how did these men, how were they allowed to get away with it so long? Why were they allowed to get away with it for so long? And how can we, a country who say that we believe certain things about justice, certain things about equal protection, that we allow men to rise to the heights of their careers, even though we know that they actively do violent forms of harm to women? And this is a unifying point between women across race and across class. The victims of Cosby's victims, many of them, the vast majority of them, were white women, many of them well-connected white women. That is true of Harvey Weinstein's victims, of his accusers, of many of the folks at the height of the Me Too movement. And it always causes me to say, if this kind of thing can happen to the most powerful women in our society, then what do you think is happening to women who are marginalized, don't have a voice, don't have access? And so these men are running scared. They are mad that they are being called to account, but it is their time. And I'm not going to be party to these arguments about the operations of race, because for my opinion, Cosby has become the worst racial stereotype of Black men. He did it through his actions. I think that he is an embarrassment to Black people, and he has had no racial loyalty to us. And so I don't understand why Black people or anybody else is going hard in the paint for him. He does not deserve it.
Well, let's talk about that other that as well, because Bill Cosby has been, you know, before this was not just considered America's dad in many ways, but, you know, Jell-O pudding pops, et cetera, et cetera. But he was also somebody who talked a lot about respectability politics, pull up your pants, don't go to prison. And it was really frustrating, I think, to a lot of folks in the Black community to hear that message over and over. Where does that fit into what we're seeing, into the narrative of Bill Cosby today, that whole idea of respectability politics?
Absolutely. So in 2004, Bill Cosby gave what is known as the infamous pound cake speech at Howard University, where he essentially said that, you know, it tells an anecdote about a Black man who gets shot after stealing a piece of pound cake. And he is less appalled at the fact that this man is shot in the head and more appalled at the notion that he steals the pound cake. And then he says things like, you know, poor people are not upholding their end of the bargain. And so he used his incredible amount of fame and respect in Black communities to actively, explicitly shame the Black poor, to shame Black folks for their sexual practices, talking about why are you having all of these children you're not taking care of. Meanwhile, he fathered children outside of his marriage. He never lived up to the standard, but he moralized and preached to Black people for the last two decades in this century about our behavior. And it turns out that he was the worst predator of them all, that he was the worst man of them all, that if it was the difference between JoJo on the corner minding his business and Bill Cosby, Bill Cosby is the man that you should have kept your daughter away from. And this is the problem with respectability politics, is that it assumes that people's economic status is some indicator of their moral prerogatives. And that is completely absurd. And so even though it is devastating to see a cultural icon turn out to be a predator, that's what I'm sad about. I'm not sad that he went to jail. I'm not sad that he has been dethroned. I am sad about the man that he is, and I am sad that this man was allowed to victimize women and that people knew about it and nobody did anything about it. And what I hope in this moment, what I hope is that he is the canary in the coal mine and that other men are going to have their day in court and their moment of reckoning. And so I hope that this is not limited to only, that justice is not going to be limited in this case only to Black men, but that all men who have done harm will have to account for their crimes.
Brittany Cooper is a professor at Rutgers University. Brittany, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Donald Trump's 2016 election victory shattered the norms of conventional politics for a lot of reasons, and one of them was his sprawling business empire, the Trump Organization, with interests both at home and around the world. When he decided not to divest himself from those interests, it left those of us trying to cover his presidency without a model for how to disentangle Trump the businessman from Trump the president. Luckily, we have the Trump Big Podcast from WNYC Studios and ProPublica looking at the intersection of business and government. And this week, Trump Inc. returns with season two. WNYC senior editor Andrea Bernstein is co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast, and she joins me now to talk about what to expect. Andrea, welcome.
So great to be here.
So exciting for season two. So tell us, in this season, you break down three categories of people who are trying to take advantage of Trump's presidency. Who are they?
Right. So what we're doing this season is broadening out from looking at just the Trump family business to also looking at people around Trump and the ways that they might be profiting from this administration. And one of the things that we know is that this incredible sort of chaos in the White House, the permeability, what it means is that all kinds of people can get the presidency here, and structures in the past that might have weeded out forms of influence peddling are just not there now. So we're seeing things like administration officials spending all kinds of government resources on travel. Just last night, we learned that the head of FEMA, remember North Carolina last week, what FEMA's supposed to be doing? The head of FEMA reimbursed the U.S. government for $151,000 of use of government vehicles, including during a family trip to Hawaii. So that's one thing we've seen throughout the Trump administration. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, took almost $1 million of flights. There was an investigation, and they said, well, it was okay, but it was not within the norms of what previous Treasury secretaries had done. So we see a lot of sort of officials who are using government resources in a way that enhance their own lifestyles. So that's the first category.
Not supposed to happen, is it? Like, that's not,
I mean, it has always happened in government, mm-hmm. but the problem is, in this current situation, is you have the president at the top using government resources. We see it every day, talking about his golf courses, his hotels, his splendid properties. On the way to his summit with Putin, he brings the entire White House press corps to his Turnberry golf course in Scotland. So that's the message from the top. That's what we see. And then the other things are people who might be using their positions, inside information to make money. And then the last category is people selling their influence to Trump for private profits. And two examples we know that happened. One was Michael Cohen, who companies like AT&T said, yeah, we paid him for access to Trump. Paul Manafort, who just pleaded guilty, was it only the week before last?
A couple weeks ago, I'm having trouble keeping track, yes.
He also had gone to a banker to get a mortgage, and we learned in court documents, suggested to the banker he could get in the job as the Secretary of the Army. That's the category that we're looking at in this episode with a man named Elliot Broidy, who is a GOP fundraiser. He has not been convicted or charged of any crimes, but because of an email hack, we know a lot about how he operated, how he got close to Trump, and how he advocated on behalf of private clients and used that access to try to get business.
And so who is Elliot Broidy? Why should we care? How did he end up in the position that he ended up with the podcast focusing on this first episode on him?
So he was advocating against the state of Qatar. He had met a businessman who had connections to the princes in Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis. And there's a sort of geopolitical dispute between those states and the state of Qatar. So Elliot Broidy, who has worked for a long time in Republican Jewish politics and for the Israel lobby, joined with these people and launched a campaign against the state of Qatar. So what he charges is the state of Qatar hacked his emails. And around last spring, reporters began getting his emails, and they paint a picture of him walking right up to Trump at various fundraising events and discussing his business, including his potential business contracts that he was going to get in the UAE. He went right to the Oval Office. So this is a story that just flew by.
And there's also another twist to the story, because there's a name that we've heard before. Stormy Daniels is part of this story.
Well, so
ish. Okay.
So what happened, the reason that most people know anything about Elliot Broidy, if they do, is that he made a $1.6 million payment to a former Playboy model, whose name is Shira Bouchard, so that she wouldn't talk about their relationship. He impregnated her. She ultimately had an abortion. And he hired, as his attorney to set up this arrangement, Michael Cohen. At the time, Michael Cohen's clients included Donald Trump, Elliot Broidy, and Sean Hannity. So one of the things that we've been looking at is at this network of people around Trump. And as we've been doing this reporting in Trump Inc., we keep saying, like, oh, my God, there's somebody that we've just heard. Here's the character from last episode who's now back in this episode. What is this? And we ended up speaking to an expert on international corruption, Sarah Chase. She wrote a book about it. And she said, oh, no, that's not an accident. When systems are getting very corrupt, you start seeing members of a network who are connected to each other and helping each other to try to profit off of public resources. And that's what we're trying to document and watch out this season of Trump Inc.
And we've got about 30 seconds left. What does that tell us about this administration? I mean, is this going to get worse, or are we just going to keep uncovering more of this, you suspect?
Well, it's not like this hasn't happened in America, but it's very easy for this has to happen. And what Sarah Chase has said is that we've been sliding down a mountain in America with regards to corruption, and with the Trump administration, we've fallen off a cliff.
Andrea Bernstein is senior editor at WNYC and the co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Great to be on.
While the nation grapples with allegations of sexual assault against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, there's another high-profile political leader who's fending off his own accusations. But that story has gotten much less spotlight. Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota is the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and in August, he easily won the Democratic nomination for Minnesota's state attorney general. But just a few days before, Ellison's ex-girlfriend came out with her own allegations of domestic abuse. Here to bring us up to speed on that story is Brianna Bierschbach. Brianna's a political reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us the quick run-up of what the allegations are against Keith Ellison and how they came about?
Yeah, a few days before the August 14th primary, an allegation appeared on Facebook from Austin Monahan, who is the son of Karen Monahan, an ex-girlfriend of Keith Ellison. And Austin said in that post that he saw a video on his mother's computer a few years ago showing that Keith Ellison was dragging her off the bed basically by her foot and yelling profanities. Later that night, Karen Monahan acknowledged that the video does exist and that this did happen to her.
And so far, Keith Ellison has denied these allegations. Is that right?
That's correct. He denied it a day after they surfaced, and he's consistently denied it throughout the campaign.
And the DNC in August said that any allegations of domestic abuse are considered serious and they would be reviewing them. But has anything happened since then? I feel like we're in, obviously, not just the Me Too movement, but also in a moment where we're looking at a lot of sexual allegations and sexual abuse allegations coming from the Republican side, but a little less prominent here on the Democratic side. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been a few months now since the allegations first popped up, and the DNC and actually the local Democratic National Party have launched an investigation, and they're doing them together. And we might be seeing that investigation as soon as potentially today, but likely this week. I mean, there's a question about what a party's investigation of their own nominee is going to look like. There's going to be a lot of questions about that. And it's potential that they find nothing and that it just kind of becomes more of the same. We've heard Republicans saying, why aren't you addressing this? And Democrats saying, well, we have. He's denying it. Let's move on.
It sounds like a story that we hear a lot, though, on the other side of the political divide. Let's move on and let's, you know, just take this person's word for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Democrats are struggling a bit with this, not just Keith Ellison and his own campaign, but Democrats up and down the ticket in Minnesota and nationally. You know, he's campaigning with a lot of prominent Democrats here, and opponents have pointed that out whenever another Democrat does that. And they're saying, you know, we have to look hard at ourselves as much as we're looking hard at Kavanaugh and all these allegations elsewhere. One of the challenges is there is a video that exists, according to Karen, but she doesn't want to produce it because she says it's embarrassing, and that in other allegations like this and other instances of domestic assault, that victims don't have to produce videos. So it's kind of a kink in this whole process that there's this big piece of evidence that people want to see, but they can't.
Now, what happens from here? I mean, is Ellison still running in the general election, and are voters reacting to this at all because this has been a story that's sort of been under the radar?
Yeah, he's still running, and he's a very prominent Democrat in the state. He really easily sailed to victory in the primary, but he's struggling a bit more in the general election. A few recent polls have come out showing that that race is pretty much neck and neck. A Minnesota Public Radio and Star Tribune poll showed he had a 5-point lead against his Republican opponent, Doug Wardlow, who is relatively unknown in the state. He served one term in the state house, hasn't been in public office for several years, and for him to be so close behind Ellison is really striking. Minnesota hasn't had a Republican attorney general in more than 50 years. And part of that poll showed that voters are really struggling with the allegations. 57% said they weren't sure if they believed Karen's allegations or not. They didn't know how to handle them in the context of this race.
And just so our listeners know, we did reach out to Ellison's campaign and congressional office and have not heard back. Brianna Bierschbach covers politics for Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Throughout the country, there are increasing numbers of women in prison. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, women's state prison population grew 834% over nearly 40 years. That's more than double the pace of the growth among men. All this week on The Takeaway, we're looking at what happens after people are released from incarceration. So when women get out, how are they adjusting?
And that's one of the hardest things for someone who's freshly out of prison to do is get a job. And so this store serves a grand purpose. And that's that grand purpose is not only to help the women inside the prison, but it helps us transition out.
That's Shazonia Horton, a woman recently released from prison who's now working at the Dragonfly Thrift Boutique in Miami, Florida. The thrift shop where she works is part of a larger project to help women transition from incarceration to being active members of their communities. Joining us to talk about this is Nadege Green, a reporter covering social justice for WLRN Miami and Miami Public Radio. Nadege, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, maybe you can give us a sense of what some of the challenges are for the women that are released from incarceration that they face when they're looking for employment.
So here in Miami-Dade in particular, one of the biggest issues is housing and transportation to even get to a job, right? So many of the women, when they're released from the Florida prison system, you're given $50 and a one-way bus pass to restart your life. And if you don't have someone to take you in, or if you don't have the support network, then it becomes increasingly difficult to take care of those basic needs before you're even able to get a job or do those things that you're supposed to do.
And you were in Miami and you found a thrift shop that helps women in with the reentry process. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. It's run by the Ladies Empowerment and Action Program, LEAP. They actually run a reentry program in the prison system. So they get to know the women in prison. They offer entrepreneurship training, therapy, and other services while the women are in prison. But one of the things a nonprofit found was this issue is like when the women are released, even though they're there to help them with reentry, there are a lot of organizations or businesses that give lip service to hiring women coming out of the prison system, but don't actually do that. And so they created this thrift store. They asked for donations, and through funding from another bigger nonprofit here, they were able to create the Dragonfly Thrift Boutique in Little Havana. And they hire the women who they work with in prison the day after their release so that there isn't this gap for them to get back and to be able to make money so that they can provide for themselves.
And do a lot of these women have ambitions beyond working at the thrift shop and doing other things? Is this just the first step for many of them?
This is absolutely the first step. So they describe this thrift store as a soft landing where the thrift store works with the women and their schedule so that they can do the basic things that they need when they're out of prison. For example, reconnecting with family members or being able to set up your parole appointments, going to the doctor. And, you know, if you've been in prison for 5 years, there are a lot of things you need to do when you get out. And very few jobs are going to give you the type of flexible scheduling that you're going to need to do those things. So the thrift store does that. But they also, all of the women, when they graduate from LEAP, when they leave prison, have a business plan. So they have an entrepreneurship plan of a business that they would like to start. They take classes with Bear University professors while they're in prison. And when they get out, the goal is to actually get them to put that plan into action. So one of the women I interviewed, she is actually starting a dog training business on the side while she's working at the thrift store. On the weekends, she's going to the parks and she's training a friend's dog. And hopefully she's passing out her business cards to try to get more business. But she learned how to train dogs in prison because while she was in prison, there was a program where inmates helped train dogs for wounded veterans.
And do you see this quickly? Do you see this as something that's able to be replicated throughout the country, or is this something that's still very small scale?
This is still small scale so far. They have three women in the pipeline, two that have been hired, one that's going to be hired. But they're definitely looking at this as a possible model for different organizations or different groups within their local communities to figure out how do you create a supportive environment for women coming out of prison beyond just offering a job, but also support.
Nadege Green is a reporter covering social justice for WLRN Miami Public Radio. Nadege, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now we turn to a story of a formerly incarcerated woman who was trained for a job but couldn't get hired after she was released.
My first years in prison were not the best. I was mad at the world and kind of really struggling with this 10-year sentence.
Amika Moda was sentenced to 10 years in prison for vehicular manslaughter that occurred when she was high on meth.
I don't know what my turning point was, but it was gradual, and my turning point I think it was started as like an internal process of just focusing on self-care and what I was going to do to shift things in my life.
Marisa Lagos, a politics reporter at KQED in San Francisco, helps tell Moda's story.
As time went on, she got very involved, and she ended up becoming a firefighter at a women's prison in Chowchilla, which is a pretty rural area of California. She was one of a team of women who would actually go out from the prison and respond within 30 miles to any incident that needed mutual aid.
I think the reason that I really wanted to be there was because it was like the best thing I could do for myself in there, right? And I also knew we would be in service in the community.
And she did this, you know, for her whole time in prison, topping out as an engineer at a whopping 53 cents an hour. So a lot of hard work, but obviously when you're an inmate, you don't make a lot of money doing these things.
But I just kept hearing, you'll never get hired by a city department. It's just not possible. They won't hire felons. So that was kind of the what had been instilled in me, and I left kind of thinking that too.
Sure enough, when she came home to Oakland, where her dad had actually been taking care of her older children, she realized that no city fire department would actually even entertain the idea of hiring a felon.
And applied at, you know, Amazon, Starbucks, a number of places like I found off of Craigslist, and was just not hearing back from folks, not even getting interviews, which was really interesting. But I also had a really huge gap on my resume, and a lot of the things a lot of folks face coming home. It's like, how do we account for this dead time?
Moda eventually did find a job, and now she works at a nonprofit helping other formerly incarcerated women. And that's where I picked up the story with Marisa.
This is something that, you know, I think we hear a lot about, but it's really interesting to talk to somebody who's so, it sums it up in the sense that she was working at this job and she literally cannot apply for the exact same job, which she is completely qualified for and had, let's say, like a ton of training that the state paid for. You know, you don't just become like walk into a fire station and become a firefighter. These women had to go through an intense training process, which is the same one that anyone at Cal Fire, you know, the state fire agency that fights our wildfires, or any city firefighters would actually go through themselves.
And I want to talk a little bit about the impact that this has just on someone's life. You know, we hear a lot today about lives being ruined, you know, particularly among prominent men. In this Me Too moment, and I keep bringing it back to, you know, someone's life could really be ruined by not just serving their time, but not being able to have a life after they've served their time. And I'm wondering, you know, is there anything that folks can do that have a criminal history, that served their time, you know, that did everything they were supposed to do to sort of get past this?
So, I mean, the reason I came across Amica's story is because a group called Californians for Safety and Justice in California, who actually have run some other ballot measures and legislation that did try to sort of reduce some penalties. So, for example, they ran Proposition 47, which reduced a lot of drug possession charges from felonies to misdemeanors, which, of course, is huge, right? Because the felony issue is the biggest one. They commissioned a report, and what they found was that in California alone, there are 4,800 laws restricting what people can do after they get out of prison. And we're talking everything from the job stuff we've discussed to housing, adopting a child, coaching a little league. You know, there's just a gamut of sort of life options that the rest of us would consider totally normal that aren't open to them. And so they're really starting a campaign that they're hoping will lead to a change in law to just raise public awareness, because they don't feel like people really know about all these limitations. And so they think that this might actually, there might be an opening here. And I will say that from my conversations with prosecutors in California, I think politically that it's actually possible that there could be some agreement between law enforcement and these reform advocates that there could be, you know, some more narrowly tailored legislation that would help people really clear these records.
Those things are important, right, to be able to give folks some sort of reset button as far as being able to obtain, you know, employment that will give us livable wages and careers.
And I'm sure there's also another side to this, which says that what balance can we strike between helping people move on after they've served their time and public safety? Is there any consideration to the type of crimes maybe that someone, may have committed and whether or not they are able to move on more quickly or have these records, whether it's cleared or expunged in some way? Does it matter if they were violent crimes, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, I talked to a couple of prosecutors in the Bay Area, one of whom, Steve Wagstaff, is in San Mateo County, and he's a fairly conservative guy who has really fought against some of the reforms we've seen in the criminal justice arena. And he said, look, I think that this is a conversation worth having.
Looking at the report, looking at their 7 recommendations that they made, I certainly see why the times have changed, and it is time to upgrade it. We have 2 things that go back decades. Number one is the request to have your record sealed. The other is by appealing to the governor, and those are the 2 present ones. I do agree for many, many crimes with a passage of time, yes, that there ought to be a third avenue where people can get that record where it's really cleaned off, not just done in name, but it's really cleaned off. I do support that approach to it for certain crimes.
I think that, I talked to George Gascon, who's the DA in San Francisco, who has been a little more liberal on these issues. And he had actually been looking at this prior to this report coming out. Both of them said that they think that this is a conversation that if, it's had and it's had in a fair way and whatever policy comes out of it is narrowly tailored, and that there might be some options for prosecutors to push back if, they felt like a certain case was different, that could be a really strong option. What's interesting to me is that district attorneys are even open to that conversation because they've been some of the biggest critics of a lot of the reforms we've seen being pushed in California in recent years.
Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tanzina.
What do audiences love about superheroes? Usually it's their power or their status as outsiders or their commitment to the fight against evil. So what does it look like when the hero is a white supremacist? A new comic called Alt Hero tells that story.
It's not subtle at all in its racism and its view of the world.
That's Al Letson, the host of the radio show Reveal. Al's also a comic book writer, and on the most recent episode, he delves into the world of Alt Hero.
On his fundraising page, you can see a video of a little white woman like cowering in the corner, and there's a big brown man with handlebar mustaches that is coming in to menace her. And then the alt hero swings in, beats the guy up, and drops him off at immigration.
The comic was created by a white nationalist named Vox Day, a man who Al says published Alt Hero with a very specific agenda.
I think that the goal for Vox Day is that he understands that comic books is a battlefront in the culture war. And what he wants to do is he wants to win the heart and minds of people who may be interested in comic books, but also be open to his message. He's had a long history in saying some really hurtful things to some really amazing science fiction writers. And the one thing that most of them have in common is that they are people of color. And so what he's trying to do is really get people to read his books and think the way he thinks, which is really targeting people of color, anybody that isn't white male. He doesn't like the comic books that are currently coming out that have women as protagonists, that have people of color as protagonists. He thinks it's killing the industry. And so that's what he's kind of fundraising on and what his stories are all about.
So is this self-funded or is there a publisher behind this?
So, it is self-funded in the sense that he does crowdfunding. And in the crowdfunding, it seems like he's making a lot of money, but we don't actually know if that's true because he created the crowdfunding platform that he raised a lot of money on. So he could just be entering numbers in and basically astroturfing, right? Getting people to believe that he's actually bigger than he is. One of the problems that we cited in our episode is that a lot of the stuff that he's putting out there is being distributed by Amazon. And when you ask Amazon why they're distributing it, they say it's because, well, he passed their criteria. And then when you look at what their criteria is about what's offensive and what isn't offensive, basically it says, like, if you think it's offensive, we probably think it's offensive. And yet—
Is that really their criteria?
That's their criteria.
Okay. And so did they not think that this was offensive?
I guess at this point they don't. I think if they hear from enough people saying that it is, they will. But at this point, they're saying that they don't.
Is this a reaction to a lot of the increasing, and this word has been used to death, but the increasing, quote-unquote, diversity in the comic book world, particularly when it comes to, as you mentioned earlier, women protagonists, protagonists of color, protagonists that are disabled, or LGBTQ protagonists? Are these comics a reaction to that?
I think what's happening for a lot of fans, a lot of fans in comic books are, you know, white guys who are used to going into their comic shop and seeing majority of their heroes be white guys because that's who created it, like back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Like, they didn't let people of color and women come in and actually create. So what's happening now is that companies are getting smarter and recognizing that diversity sells. But then you've got this white audience that feels like you're taking something away from them. So yeah, I think that like it's a response to that, and it's the push and pull. And until the market figures out how to balance those two things out, we're always going to have this tug of war.
So Al, you spoke with one writer, Chelsea Kane, and she's written for Marvel. She told you that she almost didn't even talk to you because of the trolls she's afraid of.
Because they will take you down, you know, like they are the Eye of Sauron. And when it lands on you, there is nothing but fire and rage and wrath. They absolutely have the ability to make your life a living hell.
Can you tell us a little bit about her concerns, Al?
Yeah, and I would say, like, I would cast the net a little bit wider. So for this episode, one of the things that I really wanted to do was explain to people, like, how vicious and vile these trolls can be online. And I went out and I asked about 12 to 15 comic book creators, both writers and artists, to come on record and talk to me about what happened to them. And out of those 15 people, Chelsea was the only one that would talk to me about it because it is that bad. People were just scared that if they talked to me, that it would gin it all up back again and they'd be in the crosshairs. And usually it's women and usually it's women of color. And then definitely, like, there are a lot of trans creators in the comic community. And if you're trans and you're making comic books, I mean, these trolls, they stop at no length to get you. And so, you know, we've heard from people that they get death threats, rape threats, their addresses is put online, all sorts of like really crazy things.
And of course, as journalists, I think we're both very aware of that environment. What are some things that comic book companies can do to protect some of their creators? I know you spoke with Marvel's Vice President of Content and Character Development, Sana Aminat, and here's what she had to say.
So the way that I look at it is I am a Muslim American woman who is a vice president at one of the biggest entertainment companies in the world and have been able to make a lot of big strides. That's how I take them on because I'm here and they're there and they can be as upset as they want, but we're not trying to take away anything from them.
Is that enough, Al?
I think that companies can do more. I think, you know, one of the things that Ms. Aminat said to me in the hour, which I think is valid, is that she said if Marvel or DC goes out and gets online and, like, actually says, hey, leave this creator alone, that basically it draws more trolls to the fight. And I think that that's true. I think that one of the things that, like, I've learned from talking to people is that they feel like the more you talk about it, the more, you know, the higher the intensity level gets. But I think that also companies have to get wiser. I think one of the first things that they could do is really talk to their creators and explain to them, like, these are the type of things that can happen and lay down some ways that we're going to figure out how to protect you. Two, I think that, you know, a lot of the comic book companies are scared to offend a lot of their readers. And so, like, there's this weird line that they're trying to work. And I think personally, like, you know, that's something that internally you really have to wrap your head around. Like, do you want fans that talk to other people this way? I would say not. And also that there's another fan base out there that doesn't do this type of behavior, that's longing for content. So I think that that's also another thing you have to strategize around. So, yeah, I think that the companies are in a tricky spot, but I do think that there's more that can be done.
Al Letson is the host of Reveal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, and thanks for tuning in. We also wanted to take a minute to invite everyone to be part of our listener response network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply. And you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START, START, to 69866 to join our conversation every day. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram. We're at The Takeaway. And one last thing, I spent all of last week in Puerto Rico working on a special episode about the anniversary of Hurricane Maria. The special is called After the Storm, and we decided to talk to Puerto Ricans on all sides of the political spectrum about the future of the island, its relationship to the United States, and of course, Puerto Rican identity. And we hope you'll check it out on our website or find it in the Takeaways podcast feed. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.